The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Boiling all of this down, which is how does a rule of law society, which is what the Constitution actually seeks to constitute, confront a long-term stress, which is to say persistent national security threats over a long period of time in which large numbers of people don't believe or believe are exaggerated, in the face of rapidly changing technologies, shifting global relations, a devil whom we greatly fear but whom we don't really believe in, and a healthy, traditional American skepticism about government doing nasty things like spying on people, locking people up without trial, killing people with scary flying robots, and very occasionally, and not for a very long time, but still very much in our consciousness, waterboarding people.
I'm Cody Poplin, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, September 20th, 2014. That was Benjamin Wittes you just heard. This week, the nation once again celebrated Constitution Day, and Ben gave the keynote address at Kenyon College, which we now provide to you in full. In his address, Ben covers what he calls a, quote, Constitution under stress, and how the post-9/11 world has catalyzed debate over liberties in the United States, and in turn, how the constitutional framework has shaped our response to the challenges of drones, cybersecurity, surveillance, detention, and prolonged overseas military operations. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode number 92, Benjamin Wittes on a Constitution under Chronic Stress.
Thanks very much for having me and for that very kind introduction. I plead guilty. I'm afraid I did go to Oberlin. But that has one benefit, actually, for purposes of this conversation. I had two very formative intellectual experiences in the form of outside speakers coming to Oberlin while I was there. One of them irredeemably negative, and sort of, my wife and I still sometimes swap lines from it. They were sort of that horrifying. And the other, actually life-changingly positive, and from somebody who, I guess sort of quite literally that evening sort of changed my professional direction, and a lot of what I've done subsequently, I can sort of trace in a direct line to a speaker coming to a little bit of bigger than this room, but not much, and addressing an audience on a set of contemporary issues that weren't altogether different in character from some of the ones that I want to talk about tonight. So I hope that I don't flatter myself that I will do for any of you what Leon Wieseltier did for me that evening, but I hope at least not to do what Kwame Ture did for me that evening sometime earlier. So I want to start by talking about the holiday that we're observing and why we observe it. Do people here generally know the history of Constitution Day? Now, so this is actually an interesting story about the corruption of the Constitution. Constitution Day had existed for a while. I don't know where it came from originally, but there's a reason why my speaking schedule gets crazy this week. I'm doing this talk today for Constitution Day. Tomorrow at the National Archives is having a Constitution Day panel. And on Thursday, I'm the Constitution Day speaker at, of all places, the National Security Agency. And so the question is, why are all of these organizations, including colleges, lining up to celebrate Constitution Day, which is, you know, something that we don't, like, what if I asked you to list important holidays in your life, you know, Constitution Day probably wouldn't rank very high. And the answer is, as was alluded to earlier in the introduction, a certain set of legal requirements. And so why are you guys legally required to have a Constitution Day observance? And the answer is because a number of years ago, in 2004 or 2005, Senator Robert Byrd, who thought very highly of himself, had this idea that as the personal arbiter of the Constitution and constitutional values in the Senate, he should require that all institutions that receive, educational institutions that receive federal money for education, must have a Constitution Day observance. And he slipped a little appropriations rider into a bill. I think basically nobody noticed it until all of a sudden the Department of Education sent around guidance to every institution that receives any federal educational money that says, now, from now on, you must have a Constitution Day observance. And all of a sudden, this was a great thing for people like me. Because all of a sudden, you know, normally during most of the year, like, occasionally I get asked to speak at some, but the 2 weeks around Constitution Day, a lot of people call. I want to say that not everything that's good for Ben Wittes is good for the nation. I want to suggest that this is not an unfunded mandate that the Congress should levy on every single educational institution, or for that matter, every federal agency, so that both the National Archive and the NSA have to interrupt their day in order to hear from me. That said, I'm delighted you all came out, and I want to celebrate Constitution Day by talking about some very dark subjects. As I think, normally when we talk about the Constitution, I think when Senator Byrd imagined Constitution Day, he sort of imagined that we'd all be talking about the wonderful things that the Constitution requires of us. You know, in legal terms, we talk about it in terms of free speech, right? Equal protection, separation of powers, federalism, these grand legal values that give rise to great traditions. And in more pedestrian civics class, fifth grade, eighth grade civics class, you might talk about, you know, freedom, self-government, democracy, racial equality, gender equality, human rights, checks and balances. I'm not going to talk about any of that. I'm going to talk about killing people, locking them up without trial, surveillance, and war. And I venture the guess that Bob Byrd was not thinking about any of these subjects when he required that we have this event, but I actually think they bear in significant respects on what actual constitutional governance means in the current age. And we ought to talk about not just as a kind of smile at the memory of Bob Byrd, but as a way of talking about what the Constitution really does and really regulates, let's, you know, have a conversation about some of the dark subjects that we actually deal with as a constitutional governance society. So first of all, let's talk a little bit about why we would want to talk about these things on Constitution Day. And I think the reason is that the Constitution is not actually only about pleasant stuff. The founders were really aware of that, by the way. Madison famously said that if people were angels, that government wouldn't be necessary. The Constitution is about restraints on government. It's also about empowerment of government. And we have lived through an age, and some of you have only lived through an age, in which government has taken extraordinary actions. Most of them, by the way, I have supported. So I'm not saying that as a critic. I'm saying it as an observer. Really extraordinary actions. And we have imagined to ourselves, as we are doing these extraordinary things, that we're doing them in a constitutional framework. We're doing them as a rule of law society. So my question initially, and I think it's a good question to think about if we're imagining the dark side of Robert Byrd's Holiday, are we kidding ourselves? So I was thinking about the freshmen at Kenyon College or any other college this year. So if I'm right, and my crude arithmetic isn't off, the freshman here who'd be 17 or 18 would have been 4 or 5 years old at the time of 9/11. Is that basically right? So in other words, that person has roughly the same relationship with the post 9/11 world that I had with the Cold War world as a freshman. I got to Oberlin in the fall of 1987. Glasnost and Perestroika were underway, but there was no sense of the impending fall of the Soviet Union. We still lived in a bipolar world, and it had, in my living memory, always been thus. I woke up with an awareness of the possibility of nuclear annihilation and had done so literally every day of my life. And everybody my age and older has the exact same experience. So I put myself in the shoes of the 17 or 18-year-old who shows up here and has literally never had the political experience of that period between the fall of the Soviet Union and the advent of what some people call the war on terror and some people call the quote-unquote war on terror and some people who want to avoid that call overseas counterterrorism contingency operations. I call it post 9/11 counterterrorism operations, which is probably no better. That person, and some of you, I suspect, can recognize yourself in this description, have no memory of a time when we felt unthreatened, in which our political dialogue did not assume, on the one hand, but also deny and argue over threat. You have no memory of a time when we weren't taking extraordinary actions to repel this threat that a lot of us believed in very deeply and felt very menaced by, and in a lot of us also disbelieved in and felt was exaggerated by way of justifying a set of things. Now, how does a constitutional society, how does a rule of law society mediate that basic perceptional difference? When I went to college, by the time I graduated from college, the United States was the only superpower in the world. The Soviet Union was nearly over. The Berlin Wall had fallen. All of this happened while I was at school. The day the Berlin Wall fell, I said to my friend Alex Manovich, Czechoslovakia is going to go within a week. And Alex looked at me and smiled and says, if it goes within a week, I'll bake you a cake. He baked me a cake. That was the world we lived in. What I'm really talking about here, the world that you guys have grown up in, is a world of a constitutional democracy under great stress. Now, here I'm not talking about mild stress. I'm not talking about the kind of stress that you have when, you know, something bad happens. There's in Iraq. That also happened right as I was graduating from college. We Iraq invaded Kuwait, and there was a war, and we expelled Iraq from Kuwait, and then that was over. And some people thought we should have done more, and some people thought we should have done less, but there was a period of stress, and then it was kind of over. Think of that as the stress of a breakup, right? Your basic life is going on, and then something happens, and it's stressful, and then that period of your life passes, and you're done. This is not the stress of a breakup. This is the stress of a long-term chronic illness, right? It's the stress of year after year after year of pain and anxiety and not knowing whether you're doing the right thing. And maybe it's the stress of the family member of somebody with a long-term chronic illness because you're wondering if you're handling it right. How does the Constitution think about that kind of long-term persistent stress? There are countries that have dealt with that problem over very long periods of time, the most notable in a plausibly democratic framework. The one that people talk about most often is Israel, right? So Israel has never not been at war. It has never not faced some degree of existential threat. And yet it has a recognizably rule of law society, flawed in many ways, but recognizable. Another example, less talked about, but I think in some ways more impressive, is India. So India becomes independent at almost exactly the same moment that Israel does. And it has grinding poverty. It asks people, you know, hundreds and hundreds of millions of people to vote and make meaningful political decisions who don't have bathrooms, right? This is a kind of long-term persistent stress, who can't read, right? These are what we would think of as the meaningful preconditions for political participation are so glaringly absent. And yet, it functions in a recognizably imperfectly democratic fashion over a very long period of time. The United States does not, as a society, historically have experience with long-term serious stress on through, you know, security issues on democratic governance. It has periods of extreme short-term stress. Now we have a situation. A year and a half ago, the president gave a speech in which he talked about how maybe this period of stress is actually coming to an end. He gives a speech at the National Defense University in which he talks about the end of the war. He talks about how we need to repeal the authorization for the use of military force. And he felt really passionately about it. I mean, you could tell he was passionate because it was a politically dumb speech to give. I mean, I'm not saying that I actually sympathize with a lot of the things he was saying. There was no good political argument for making the speech. He gave it anyway. That means he believed it, right? And yet less than a year and a half later, the president is using the very instrument, legal instrument, the authorization for the use of military force, that he called on Congress to work to refine and repeal. He is now interpreting that in a fashion so dramatically in excess of anything that any previous administration, his or the Bush administration, had read into it, that not even I can support it. And I've really argued for a broad interpretation of the AUMF. I can't even support the reading that they're attaching to this anymore. The stress we imagined, as recently as a year and a half ago, the President of the United States stands in front of the country, gives a major address, imagining that we are at the period of the end of the stress. And then we had Edward Snowden, right, like a month afterwards. And we had a year-long agonizing debate about a whole new front in this stress, which is this question of surveillance, of signals intelligence, of civil liberties in this specific context. And then just as that was winding down, this little group that the president had only recently dismissed as the junior varsity of terrorism takes over a large swath of Iraq and triggers a major international intervention under the AUMF. In your lifetimes, since you were 4 or 5, not for 1 week has there been a time when the sources of stress, the expressions of stress, have not dominated our headlines. They haven't been the only things that dominate our headlines, of course, but just listen to this sequence. It'll remain, some of this will be before your political memories. In the immediate period after 9/11, we had the Patriot Act, huge debate over the Patriot Act. That was fundamentally a set of issues about surveillance. Just as that was winding down, we started capturing people, 10,000 people in Afghanistan. We had to decide what to do with them. We had a convulsive societal debate that still has not ended about under what circumstances you could or could not detain them outside of the traditional criminal justice system. That debate has largely wound down because the legal questions have answered, but people aren't really comfortable with the answer to that. Do you get a little bit uncomfortable when somebody refers to Guantanamo, right? It doesn't sound like a nice thing. When that was winding down, contemporaneously with that, we had a wrenching societal debate about under what rules you should and should not try those people you're going to bring to trial, assuming that you're bringing people to trial at all. Is it okay to use a military commission? We dramatically expanded the criminal law in a whole range of areas. This actually was not terribly convulsive as a society. We just did it. A whole lot of things are illegal today that weren't illegal 15 years ago. Give you an example of that. Does anybody here remember a guy by the name of Larry Wayne Harris? So Larry Wayne Harris was a former member of the Aryan Nations. Had a little bit of a biological fetish. He was interested in biological warfare agents. And so he did what any right-thinking American would do if you're worried about an impending apocalypse and you really don't like racial minorities and you somehow think all of this has to do with biological warfare agents. You would, of course, call your local biological agent distributor and order some bubonic plague, which is what he did. And the FBI did what, somebody at the company was alert to the fact that this was a little strange. And so he alerted the FBI that there was something weird going on. And the FBI descended on Larry Wayne Harris's house and couldn't prosecute him for anything. Because in 1995, when this happened, 1994 maybe, it actually wasn't illegal to buy bubonic plague by mail order. That's the world we lived in when I graduated from college. You know, the Soviet Union, if they were going to launch a biological weapons attack, they weren't going to use Amazon.com to buy their bubonic plague, okay? Amazon didn't exist anyway. All kinds of things are illegal now that didn't used to be illegal. Some of them are really uncontroversial, like you're just not allowed to buy bubonic plague by mail order anymore. Some of them are really controversial, actually. You know, things that you might do in collaboration with a group that the State Department regards as a terrorist group can land you in jail for a really long time. A lot of people have gone to jail under the material support laws. That was not illegal prior to first 2002 and then 2004 changes in the law. Lots of things that you used to be allowed to do, you're not allowed to do anymore. Has anybody seen the movie Bullet? One of the great early 1970s cop movies. I think it's Steve McQueen. And the end scene in Bullet takes place in an airport concourse. And the cop is chasing the criminal, waving a gun. They're both got guns out down an airport concourse. And there's something that doesn't happen. There's no airline security. There's no security checkpoint. 1972. You didn't have to go through a magnetometer to get on an airplane. You didn't have to take off your shoes. How many people here remember why you have to take off your shoes to go through an airplane? Okay, so we got, how many people who are students remember many fewer? You know, these are specific events that happened. Somebody tried to bomb a transatlantic flight with a bomb in his shoes right after 9/11. And in response, the TSA, which was not yet the TSA, said, now everybody's got to take off their shoes. These are things that changed in response to a country under persistent stress. When you watch Bullet today, it's weird to see, you know, the bad guy and the cop running through an airport with their guns out, and there's no place where everybody's lined up to go through a checkpoint. I got interested in this field, what we now call national security law. We used to call it other things. When I was a young reporter for a now defunct newspaper called Legal Times. There was an incipient thing going on in the then Clinton administration. The deputy attorney general. So we had had a bombing at the World Trade Center. Of course, the first World Trade Center bombing had been conducted by foreign terrorists, actually based in New Jersey, but foreign to New York. And there was a concern, Hamas, then as now a problem in the world, had decided in the mid-1990s that there was this great idea that they had for how to disrupt what was then a very promising peace process between the Palestinian, what's now called the Palestinian Authority, and the Israelis. And what Hamas figured out, nobody had really done a lot of suicide bombings before. There had been a couple, but it was not a, when we thought of terrorism, we generally thought of airplane hijackings, not suicide bombings. And Hamas, it's actually one of those great moments in terrorist entrepreneurship where I'm not joking when I say that. You know, most terrorists are really uninteresting and boring. They do whatever worked last time. But occasionally you get these moments where the terrorists figure something out, and it's really insightful. And what Hamas figured out in 1994 and 1995 was that if you strapped enough people with explosive vests and walked onto Israeli buses and blew up buses and killed 15 or 20 people at a time, you could derail the entire Israeli-Palestinian peace process. And they did it, and it worked, and the Israeli government fell. And the Israeli people did not vote in a comparable government after that. So this is an example of terrorist success, right? If you measure action against their political objectives. So at this period in 1994, 1995, 1996, 1995, we have the Oklahoma City bombing. Sudden attention on the part of the Clinton administration to the fact that, boy, there's a problem, right? And the problem is that people are raising money in the United States for overseas terrorist organizations. And boy, there are these people domestically who were really sponsoring mass casualty events. And by the way, you can park a bomb in the basement of the World Trade Center and really mess things up. They only killed 5 people, but it did a lot of damage and scared a lot of people. And so the Clinton administration starts thinking about this problem of how to integrate intelligence and law enforcement, which we'd traditionally thought of as very distinct domains, right? Intelligence is what you do overseas. If you do it domestically, that's J. Edgar Hoover, and you're probably violating somebody's civil liberties. And law enforcement is the way that citizens and their government interact with one another. And there were about 5 reporters who found this development in the Clinton administration interesting. I was one of them. I found it fascinating, and I found the people who were doing it fascinating. And there was one person in particular who I found really fascinating, who was the woman who was driving this whole train, whose name was Jamie Gorelick, and who was deputy attorney general in this period of the Clinton administration. She's a very, she's just a powerhouse of a human being, and had an insight that this was a set of very, very serious problems. And so I got interested in this project that they were engaged in. And along the way, I learned about this institution that nobody had ever written anything about. I mean, literally, nobody had ever written anything about. It was called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. You may have heard of it. And the FISA court, which is sometimes called the FISC, had a presence. It was literally in the Justice Department. And I decided, an editor of mine said to me, you know, we should do something and learn everything we can about this institution. There's an institution of the federal judiciary that operates entirely in secret. It's sitting there in the Justice Department, and nobody's ever written anything about it. So let's actually go find out everything we can find out about it. Take however much time you need. Just go do it. So it's not often as a young reporter you get kind of loosed on a project like that. So I spent a bunch of time looking at this institution, and you know you're in trouble in terms of public reception when you can't even persuade your parents that it's important. My parents were making fun of me about this. I was just really insightful, or maybe it was that I was just happened upon something that was going to turn out to be really important. I happened on things that really turned out to be uninteresting too. Over the next few years, the FISA court became one of these institutions that reflected this stress, right? It's the institution that supervises NSA in all of these counterterrorism and non-counterterrorism programs that it conducts surveillance for. It's the institution that when people talk about having judicial review in drone strikes, right, they sometimes want to talk about letting the FISA court supervise that, right? So we have this weird relationship with this court, which is we're really uncomfortable with it, and please give it lots more power in lots of different areas. The FISA court is something we love to hate, but every reform gives it more power. So where do these sources of stress come from? So I want to sort of like break through to the higher ground. I don't want to talk, I'm happy to talk in the Q&A about individual issues. But I want to talk about the big problem of democracies that are rule of law societies facing these stresses. And I want to try to identify what these stresses are. People just say, well, terrorism. Yeah, but every country faces terrorism right now, right? And it's not just terrorism. One source of the stress is the post-9/11 world. One source of stress in the post-9/11 world is terrorism, that we do not believe anymore that we are safe. We used to think that the oceans, you know, were pretty good. They're not good enough. Second source of stress is technological change. And this is not anybody's fault, right? In fact, by and large, it's a good thing. We keep developing new products. Drones, they're big, scary flying robots. And we've never had big, scary flying robots before. And so we have this problem. Suddenly we have this ability to sit in Nevada and kill you, but not you, in Afghanistan. That's a real challenge. Different people are going to disagree about what the right way to use that power is. Is there a right way to use that power? Should you refrain from using that power? Should you embrace that power? Because, boy, sometimes it's a great thing to be able to kill the target and not the person next to the target. We have very different moral instincts about how you use new technologies that are radically empowering as they arise. And it's not just or principally governments and militaries and the CIA that get these technologies. You're all carrying them in your pockets. Devin referred to my cyborg paper in the introduction. Cyborg paper is about the fact that you are integrating with technology in a way that you're probably not even conscious of, but is makes you like a superhero compared to, like, when I was a kid, what I thought would have thought of as superpowers, the ability to talk to somebody who isn't there. You know, if I wanted to talk to somebody who wasn't there, I had to go over to a phone, know their number, dial it. You know, if you want to talk to somebody who isn't there, you don't even have to speak. You just go like this, right? These are incredible powers, and they come with weird features. So one of the weird features is that everybody in the world, all the time, is connected to the same communications architecture. You don't think about that. You call it the internet, and it's just this thing. But that's the first time in the world, the history of the world, that's ever happened, and it means that you can spy on anybody really easily. It also means that you can spy on anybody really easily. It's not just government that can do it. You know, there are these companies that if you want to stalk somebody, that's what they do for a living. They help you stalk people. And you know what happens? It turns out, I learned this on NPR this morning or yesterday, that domestic violence shelters all over the place are not letting people use certain technologies because they are presumptively subject to being stalked using them, because that's how domestic violence perpetrators are acting now, right? So you think it's just NSA, but it's not NSA. It could be the person you're dating, right? Surveillance, when I got interested in the FISA court, it didn't really matter to people. It was this weird thing that a few national security nerds, tech people, and weird journalists like me found fascinating. But people didn't think it had anything to do with them, because they weren't doing anything that would cause anybody to surveil them, and you're not going to get surveilled by accident. Well, guess what? Now you are doing things that people will care about enough to conduct surveillance against. The price of doing the surveillance, both in the public sector and in the private sector, is radically crashing. And by the way, you're much more interesting than you thought you were, if only because you have credit card numbers. And people really care about it all of a sudden. So this area that was just the province of a few of us weird nerds, suddenly Edward Snowden is an international celebrity. Technological change is a very deep component of it. Third component of the source of stress in the democracy is a very deep social disagreement as to the reality and magnitude of the problems at issue. Right? You don't have to be Dick Cheney to believe that the ISIL folks are really, really scary. They, you know, behead people and take videos of them. They take selfies of themselves beheading people. And so when we see that, we get very, 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 very scared. And then a long time passes in which we don't see anything. And we unlearn the fear. Who here has seen the movie The Usual Suspects? Okay, it's great, great. You should all see it. But there's a wonderful scene in which Kevin Spacey, who's actually the, I don't want to spoil it for you. He says, the greatest trick the devil ever pulled is convincing the world he didn't exist. translate that. This is one of the deepest lines that has ever been in an American movie, or maybe any movie. It is Al-Qaeda, right? The more successful you are in counterterrorism, the less people believe that there is actually a problem that requires dealing with. After 9/11, nobody doubted that there was a serious problem. Now, 9/11 happens. A few weeks later, somebody starts mailing anthrax, live anthrax, through the mail, kills a bunch of people. And a few weeks after that, nobody remembers this. A plane takes off from JFK in New York and crashes into a residential neighborhood in Queens. A lot of people got killed. And nobody remembers this incident. And the reason nobody remembers this incident is because it was an accident. Nobody thought it was an accident the day it happened. Nobody. The only question, we've got wall-to-wall coverage on every network as the latest terrorist attack, and everyone was shocked to find out that it was a set of technical malfunctions of a type that doesn't really happen in commercial aviation anymore. And it was really tragic, and that's all it was. And we were all shocked to learn that. So if I get on my plane tomorrow at Columbus, and it takes off and crashes into a residential neighborhood in Columbus, how many of you will assume it's a terrorist attack? Well, we got maybe half of one vote, okay? So that's a reflection of the difference in climate. The more successful you are in counterterrorism, the less people believe in the problem. The less successful you are, the more people believe in the problem. That is a very big, big conceptual problem for a world of popular sovereignty in which what we think, what problems we believe in, actually matters. Another way to think about that question is to say, are we dealing here? A lot of people, you know, just don't believe in that the problem that we face justifies the actions that we're taking. They imagine, so think of it, to use Kevin Spacey's line, is the devil we're facing, right, the devil of Christianity, which is a menacing, omnipresent, you know, very tricky monster who's trying to fool you and trick you into complacency, into evil, into not believing in him? Or is it the devil of sort of secular skepticism, right? The devil who priests have imagined in order to lure you and fool you into compliance? This is the recurrent push-pull of how we think about this threat. Last big component is the globalization of the problem. We don't live in a bipolar world. We don't live in a world in which U.S. power enough alone is enough to do very much. It can do some things, particularly close at hand. But we need partners. We need partners for most things of consequence you do. You can see that in the ISIL thing right now. We're trying to build a coalition. But less visible, if you've read the NSA stories carefully over any length of time, nothing NSA is doing, very little, is on its own. It's working with partners, partner intelligence services, partner companies that are working with it either voluntarily or under court compulsion. We like to think, because it's convenient, because it's intellectually kind of the way the world should work, right, in our IR theory worlds, that domestic level variables don't matter, that states act according to their interests, you know, all these sort of things that I'm sure some of you have spent time in classes here. And it's all true in some theoretical level, and it's not true if you're a government official who actually is dealing with domestic level variables all the time and is dealing also with very complex interactions with people you need to help you at the corporate level, at the foreign partner level. And by the way, many, many countries have leverage in this conversation. So the globalization feature is really important It's not all up to American constitutional democracy. So, okay, let's boil this down to a core question. And I actually did something I almost never do, which is I wrote it down, because it's a complex sentence. Boiling all of this down, which is, how does a rule of law society, which is what the Constitution actually seeks to constitute, confront a long-term stress, which is to say, persistent national security threats over a long period of time in which large numbers of people don't believe or believe are exaggerated, in the face of rapidly changing technologies, shifting global relations, a devil whom we greatly fear but whom we don't really believe in, and a healthy traditional American skepticism about government doing nasty things like spying on people, locking people up without trial, killing people with scary flying robots, and very occasionally, and not for a very long time, but still very much in our consciousness, waterboarding people. All right, so that's the problem. Now I'm going to talk for about 5 minutes about the answer to the problem, because that's actually where my thought is kind of weak. And then I'll open it up. The Constitution actually is an unusual document in providing for some interesting features, in creating some interesting features that offer elements of answers to this question. So unlike a lot of European constitutions, has anybody ever spent any time reading the Maastricht Treaty or any of the European constitutional documents? Don't. So these are remarkably long, turgid, detailed, scripted. They're more like, think of what we would call statutory law in this country. They're incredibly picayune and minute, and they almost never state anything that would be recognizable to an American reader as a principle. It's a code of regulations. These emerge largely out of civil law traditions that like to try to answer every question prospectively. It's kind of not the way American law operates. That's why our Constitution is a lot older, right? Now, the Constitution, by and large, speaks in principles, not in rules. There are some rules in it, but they're not the things that we remember the Constitution for. So, at the working functional level, the Constitution provides the rule that the president can't be younger than 35. That's actually a pretty clear rule, right? Much of the time when the Constitution tries to get into rulemaking, it gets ridiculous. It's not why we remember the Constitution. It doesn't ever smack of greatness. So how many of you can tell me the principle of the First Amendment? Yeah, just show of hands. Do you have a sense of what the First Amendment is? Right, like everybody? Okay. How many of you can give me a sense of what the Seventh Amendment says? I got one, two, maybe three. All right, let me read you the Seventh Amendment, or at least in relevant part. In suits at common law, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved. Okay, so here you have the fund. Now, I venture to say that if the Constitution had looked more like the Seventh Amendment than the First Amendment, it would not have lasted until now, right? Because one thing, actually, the first Congress had a lot of people who understood the concept of inflation. Both Madison and Hamilton, actually, Hamilton in particular, was a very sophisticated economist. But they missed the boat on this one, right? If you're trying to establish a lasting principle, ascribing a dollar amount to trial by jury is probably a bad move. So these are actually the exceptions in the Constitution. There are a few of them, and they're really anachronistic and weird. There are very few of them. The broader thing about the Constitution is that it talks in language of big ideas that are adaptable. Due process, separation of powers, those nice things that I said I wasn't going to talk about, I'm not going to talk about them because that would violate the spirit of the conceit of this talk. But they're there, and they actually provide a real disciplining quality, that an adaptable quality that lets the society is at different times mediate these problems and disputes in creative and different ways without a very strict constitutional code that prescribes certain answers and proscribes other answers. It contains restraints. It does set limits. You can't do unreasonable searches. You can't deny people due process. You can't suspend habeas corpus except under certain very special circumstances. Now, one of the things that people say about the government in the post-9/11 era, you know, people say they've trampled on the Constitution, they've trampled on due process, they've trampled on the Fourth Amendment, they've shredded, right? You get these verbs of great violence. And yet if you read the things that the government isn't doing, they're conditioned by those words, right? Without the idea of a ban on unreasonable search and seizures, NSA would be doing much more. So we can argue with the case law. We can argue that their interpretation is wrong. It's very hard to argue that there isn't a restraint. The Constitution also creates permissions. We don't talk about the permissions very often, but there's actually a lot of affirmative permissions in the Constitution. The president is commander-in-chief of the military. That implies the ability to give orders. That's a permission. Congress has the authority to make rules for captures on land and sea. It's a beautiful little phrase. Make rules for captures on land and sea. If you're going to capture 10,000 people in Afghanistan, which we do, don't you want to have a Congress that can make rules for captures on land and sea? The other, you know, recently, over the last couple of years, we've captured some guys from al-Shabaab at sea. Ahmed Warsami, we caught him in a boat. Congress can make rules for captures on land and sea. Congress can declare war. And most fundamentally, Congress can make all kinds of new laws, which we talked about before. That's an affirmative permission. Most fundamentally, there's this joint and shared power between the president and Congress to regulate and conduct warfare. President has power to make treaties. This is incredible power. We don't use it very much. It's the power, when we talk about the need for foreign partners, Constitution gives the president power to negotiate and get partners, build coalitions, right? Creates a structure for shared accountability and decision-making for this set of things that I call on my website, Lawfare, hard national security choices. Doesn't give you a lot of answers to the question, but it frames the discussion in a fashion that is very disciplining in a lot of ways. So we see that in a lot of places. I'm going to stop here, just going to tick them off. You can see all three branches of government struggling with the fallout from the Snowden revelations, right? The courts are adjudicating whether the conduct is lawful. The executive branch is refining its own conduct in a number of areas. Congress, in consultation with the legislative, with the executive, is thinking about how to reform what it did, what it permits, how to change what it permits. You can see it in the knockdown and drag-out fight that some of you are probably following between the CIA and the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence over the committee's 6,000-page history of the CIA's coercive interrogation program. Why does the Senate committee care what the CIA did to a small group of detainees 10 years ago? And the answer is you know, it may seem obvious why they care, but it actually is it's an interesting question. Why should we care? And the answer is because we have shared responsibility and accountability in terms of what we permit and what we don't permit, and that drives an oversight regime in which the Senate actually has to care. That's an example of that structure influencing in a very profound way at the level of writing 6,000 pages and arguing in this brutal fashion about which past lines of 600 pages of it you're going to redact before you declassify. You can see it in the long term and iterative and deeply fascinating, and some of you should, you know, do your theses on it in your senior years, the back and forth between the military, the courts, and Congress over how to handle the detention cases at Guantanamo. You have courts, you have very rarely do you have such a perfect case study in the development of law from nothing to highly developed in an iterative conversation between three branches of government. And right now, you can also see it in the back and forth between the president and Congress over congressional authorization for a campaign against ISIL. Why does the president care what Congress has to say about this subject? Why does he care? If he gives an order to the military, they're going to follow it. Why does he care? The key point is that the system is designed to force compromises, and it's designed to hold people accountable, to make sure that somebody's accountable for very fateful decisions. It doesn't always work, but it actually, in this space, has worked, I think, remarkably well, which is why we're a democracy under stress, but we're not imploding from the stress. Thanks very much. So I'd be happy to take whatever questions people want to hurl at me. Yeah. I think you're supposed to wait for the microphone, which I probably should have said.
Yeah, this is easier. You mentioned the age of the Constitution, and I know that confers many benefits, stability, civic pride, for example, but do you think that in this specific context, the fact that our Constitution has no language about flying robots and surveillance via the internet is a bit of a disadvantage? And if so, how do we approach that?
So there is a very good argument that we don't have enough Constitution. And the argument was made, I think, most pithily by Richard Posner, who is a very distinguished and very eccentric judge on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. And when I was finishing writing Law in the Long War, I asked him, you know, what do you make of it? Why, you know, people think the Constitution answers all these questions. It doesn't answer these questions. And we all talk as though the Constitution just says whatever we wish it had said, right? But it doesn't really say what we wish it says. It often doesn't say anything at all. And Judge Posner said to me, yeah, the Constitution is old. Old and short. And he said it with derision. That made me a little bit uncomfortable, that a federal judge who serves under Article 3 of that Constitution felt that almost contemptuous of the Constitution's answering of questions. I think it is mostly virtue. I don't think the Constitution represents the ground rules for life in a democracy. It creates the structures, and it says what the structures are and are not allowed to do in very broad terms. I don't think we have a social agreement about, imagine the scary flying robot clause of the Constitution. What would it say, right? And there are people who would say it should say no scary flying robots, and there are people who would say it should say lots of scary flying robots. And there are people who would say it should say scary flying robots for this and for that. And before you know it, you're in this European model of writing a code, right? So we tried that. There are these historical examples where we tried to amend the Constitution to do things that there wasn't social agreement to do. The most famous of them is prohibition. It doesn't work that well. And it really doesn't work that well if the technology changes really fast. So I told this story at dinner. For those of you who were there, I apologize for telling it again. In 1897, the world saw the scary flying robots. And they got together and they created an international treaty to ban scary flying robots. I'm actually not making this up. It's part of the Hague Convention. Those of you who have computers open can Google it. It's the Balloon Warfare Convention. The balloon warfare provisions of the Hague Resolution ban lighter-than-air flying machines, zeppelins, balloons, in warfare. Because they saw this menace to life emanating from new technologies, and they got together and they banned it. And 6 years later, the Wright brothers, you know, made that point a little moot. And our struggles with air power internationally did not end there. My friend Stuart Baker, who used to be actually the general counsel of the NSA some time back, but Stuart tells this story that I was historically unaware. I was unaware of the history of this. But in the very beginning of World War II, before the United States was involved, Franklin Roosevelt cabled and spoke to both the British senior leadership and Hitler. And the neutral United States exacted a commitment from both that they would not use aerial bombardment of civilian cities. And both the Nazis and the British agreed to this. And for the first many months of the war, both scrupulously adhered to it. We don't think of the Nazis as, you know, generally speaking, adhering to the laws and rules of warfare. They did this. And of course, the reason they did this was that they didn't want Berlin to get bombed. So they didn't bomb London. This ended when a single British plane dropped by accident a single bomb over Berlin. And at that point, Hitler made a speech in which he said, if they bomb our cities, we'll bomb their cities. And that was what launched the Battle of Britain. We have struggled with the question of air power. And the thing that has answered it over time involves, by and large, not constitutional law, right? The thing that answers it over time is developments in the laws of war, first and foremost. And secondly, technological capability. So I think the idea that there's a scary flying robot clause to be written at the Constitution is probably fanciful. The idea that there's something more that we might say constitutionally about surveillance, which is, after all, an area that the Constitution, we do have a whole amendment devoted to it, right? Unreasonable searches and seizures are not allowed, and generally speaking, you need a warrant. That's what the Constitution says. I'm not actually averse at all to the idea that we should have more to say about that constitutionally than we do, whether it may develop more in the form of case law than in the form of written, you know, amendments to the Constitution. But it's definitely an area where the constitutional law is going to speak to it.
I have a question about the devil.
I'm not a theologian.
So if I understood you correctly, you said that the more successful your counterterrorism efforts are, the less likely people are to believe in the devil, which is to say, into the seriousness of the problem. Is that correct?
Yes.
My impression is that in Europe, people are generally much less worried about this devil, that they are kind of surprised at the extent of fear in the U.S. So does that mean that their counterterrorism efforts are more successful?
First of all, most international terrorism has not been directed against European countries. Most European experience with terrorism has been of a local variety. And there's a very big difference between the United States and at least continental Europe. So the Germans have a really significant experience with terrorism, but it's German people engaged from the far left and sometimes the far right in local attacks. Similarly, the British have a pretty significant experience. More recently, British experience with terrorism is almost entirely homegrown. Now, there's another wrinkle, which is that the less terrorism, since most European countries do not have substantial overseas counterterrorism operations, and the principal beneficiary of a lot of U.S. counterterrorism operations overseas are European countries. When you know that the U.S. is failing at counterterrorism, the reason will not be that bombs start going off in the United States. The canary in the coal mine will be that bombs start going off in Europe. And so your point is well taken. It is not European foreign counterterrorism efforts that are, if there is a devil that is being restricted here, it's probably mostly U.S. operations, not European operations that are at issue. Now, there's another wrinkle here that I think is, you're absolutely right that Europeans are generally more skeptical than Americans of robust counterterrorism operations. And one question is why? Because actually Europe is much more exposed than the United States is, much bigger, much more disaffected populations of much broader experience of recent political violence in a lot of European countries. And I think, broadly speaking, I am not in any sense a scholar of European politics or political attitudes. I did spend some time recently in Germany. If you want to ever have a really rollicking good time, go to Germany to defend the NSA. I felt like I should be wearing a big cowboy hat and boots. And I think there is a, particularly in Germany, but in some of the other countries as well, there is a very different set of experiences with government power. And I think if I were somebody who my recent political memories included not just the Gestapo, but also the Stasi, my risk calculation might be very different than somebody whose basic experiences with intelligence is that it helps you do the things you need to do in foreign policy, and your basic experience with counterterrorism is it stops bad things from happening. And your basic experiences with the excesses of both and the abuses that arise in both is that they're things that we struggle to get under control, and we largely do. And I think if you have a very different, countries that have a sort of optimistic experience of their governments, Britain, United States, Australia, are going to have a very different perception of the relative threat from their government versus from the things their government is attacking, that countries that have a sort of deeply pessimistic view of what their government will and won't do. we train ourselves emotionally and intellectually. So most kids, at some very deep emotional level, believe there are monsters in their closets and under their beds. It's dark. They see monsters. And where would the monsters be, right? They'd be under their beds and in their closets. That's where you'd hide if you were a monster and you wanted to get a kid. And their parents say to them, well, there are no monsters. And the kids, at some level, intellectually believe that, but they don't emotionally believe it. The moment the parents leave, they're still afraid of the monsters in the bed. So what actually trains the kid that there are not, in fact, monsters under the bed and in the closet? It's years and years of experience of opening the closet and not having a monster jump out. It's years and years of experience of lying in bed and not having the monster crawl out and grab you, right? And if you don't have years and years and years of not having government behave tyrannically, you're not the kid who learns that that the monster under the bed actually doesn't exist and it's not the government. And if you're the person for whom, and I'm one of them, you know, for whom the monster jumped out and that happened and that was, you know, life-changing and scarring, it takes a very long time to retrain yourself that there's actually no monster under the bed or in the closet. But eventually, you do it. And I don't get scared of things that scared me in the months immediately after 9/11. And so that emotional training is a huge component both of European and American experience, but they're different experiences and they're different emotional trainings that arise. And it's not just that arise, that recur and recur and recur. What you train yourself is the monster that is under the bed, that isn't under the bed. They're different.
Thank you.
We went from devils to monsters. Yes, right in back of you. Oh, sorry.
Where is it going? Hi, okay. So you described the Constitution as being mostly virtue and...
Well, the brevity and, right, and age.
Right. And so with the issue of surveillance, which is marked by a conflict between the virtues of liberty and security, does the Constitution contain any hints as to a ranking of those virtues?
So the Constitution doesn't explicitly talk much about security at all. It talks about war powers. It talks about the power to do things. It assumes that one of the essential purposes of government is to provide for the common defense, right, which is actually in the language of the preamble. It's one of the purposes. There is no security clause, right? There's an underlying background assumption that providing security is simply one of the purposes of government. And so just as there's no general welfare clause, there's no justice clause, right? There's no... The basic things that government is supposed to provide don't have clauses. They're the background assumption of what any government would try to do. And the Constitution lays out the restrictions on your ability to do that. So if I say to you, so take it out of the realm of constitutional law, put it in the realm of economic behavior, right? We don't have to tell people, you want to go make some money. You know, go out there, we live in a capitalist society, we're not going to give you the go out and make money direction. We're going to just sort of assume that people are going to try to do that. And we put limits on their ability to do it. So we don't say in the criminal law, you know, you shall go out and make money, but don't bribe anybody, right? We just say, don't bribe anybody. And the Constitution's sort of like that. It doesn't say, you know, go out and make life better for people. It just kind of assumes that people are going to vote for people who are going to try to make life better for them, and that people are going to make promises in that regard. Security is sort of like that. So it's an actually under-discussed feature. There are these certain things that Congress is allowed to do, issue letters of marque and reprisal, which nobody does anymore. These are like, you can be a state-sponsored pirate and go sink British shipping. Haven't really used that since the War of 1812. There are these affirmative things that you're allowed to do, but it never talks about the ranking of values because they operate on different planes. One is the set of things that government tries to do, we just assume. The other are the list of things that we restrict government from doing because they pose an intolerable threat to liberty. Sorry, I think you were supposed to be next, yes?
It's quite all right. I needed the time to think of a good question.
Uh-huh.
All right. You talk a lot about the relative merits of security versus freedom. What do you think of, I believe it's the Thomas Jefferson quote, that those who value security over freedom deserve neither?
It's an excellent question. So first of all, it's Franklin, it's not Jefferson.
Oh, okay.
And it is one of the most adorably misquoted lines in the entire American political tradition. So a few years ago, I got quoted this line at me once too often, because the assumption was always that I deserved neither, right? And so the exact quote is that the one who would trade essential freedoms in exchange for a little temporary safety deserves neither. It's a beautiful line. It's actually carved on a plaque in the Statue of Liberty. Everybody quotes it all the time, and nobody knows where it comes from. So I said to my research assistant, we got to figure out where this line comes from, because Ben Franklin was a really smart guy. And the way people quote that line, it's kind of dumb. You know, of course you trade, you know, people trade liberty and security off against one another all the time. And we do it, actually, a lot of the time we think that's a good thing. So if you have a serial rapist walking around town, you really want to trade his liberty for lots of other people's security. We don't think of that as a bad thing to make that trade. We call it law enforcement, right? We call it protection of the population. So I was thinking this quote is too dumb. It's very beautiful, but it's too dumb for Franklin actually to have said it the way it's constantly quoted. So I asked Ritika, just go find out where it comes from. And it turns out this is really hard, because nobody knows where it comes from. It took weeks and weeks to find it, where it comes from. And it actually comes from a letter. The reason people have trouble hunting it down is that the letter that it comes from is not signed by Benjamin Franklin. It's signed by the Pennsylvania General Assembly. And it is assumed, probably accurately, to have been written by Franklin. But we don't actually know that for sure. But let's assume it was. It reads like Franklin. So here's the context that gives rise to this quote. And you'll see why it amuses me so much. This takes place during the French and Indian War. Now, Pennsylvania at the time was a very weird colony. It was ruled by it was a proprietary colony ruled by the family of William Penn. And that meant that Penn was essentially dictator of this colony. Now, there was a General Assembly that could make laws, but Penn would appoint the governor. And the governor, by this time, William Penn was dead, but his family was still the proprietary owner of the colony, essentially. And the governor had to do what they said, because they could remove him. And a lot of the land in the state was owned by the Penn family. Though the Pennsylvania General Assembly, in the person of Benjamin Franklin, who was sort of a great civic leader, really thought it was wrong that they couldn't tax the Penn family lands. And the French Indian War started, and the French and the Indians were actually doing pretty well. The Indians were raiding these Western farms out in the Lancaster area. And they needed to fund frontier defense. And so the General Assembly kept passing bills taxing everybody, including the Penn family lands, in order to fund frontier defense. And the governors, at the behest of the Penn family, who really didn't want their lands to be taxed, kept vetoing them. And finally, the Penn family basically proposed a compromise, which was that they would give a lump sum for frontier defense if the legislature would acknowledge that it didn't have the authority to tax them. And in exchange, Ben Franklin writes that this would be a contemptible trade because those who would trade essential liberty in exchange for a little temporary safety, purchase essential liberty, a little temporary safety with essential liberty deserve neither. In other words, what did Ben Franklin want to do? He wanted a legislature to have the power to govern in the interests of collective security. And he thought it was, that's the liberty he thought it was contemptible to trade. And he wanted, and he thought it was essential that the people have the ability to do that. He wasn't talking about civil liberties in the sense that we use the term now. He wasn't talking about individual rights. He was talking about governance. So I think, actually, Ben Franklin was a very wise man, and he's saying very much in the context of his time, which is that, you know, you actually have to make rules and you have to have the ability to govern and play with different options. Very much similar, actually, to what I am sort of generally arguing now, much more so than it is to the people who normally quote him.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, please spread the word and promote the Lawfare podcast on your social networks, including Twitter, Facebook, email, and any other way you can. Thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.